Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and Anna Mateo. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
A dead farm animal that floated across the sea from China to an island held by Taiwan has upset Taiwanese officials. They are concerned because tests showed that the hog carried a disease that could affect the island's pig farming industry. The pig washed up on December 31st on Kinmen, a small island held by Taiwan. Local agricultural inspectors carried out tests and found that the hog had African swine flu. The infectious disease led to the destruction of at least 600,000 pigs last year in mainland China. Taiwanese officials want China to provide more information about the hog so officials can prevent the swine flu from spreading to Taiwan. But officials in Beijing have not answered a letter about the incident from Taiwan's Council of Agriculture. Some experts consider the lack of communication as a sign that relations between the sides have worsened. Huang Kuibo is with National Chengchi University in Taiwan. He said, when relations are better, Beijing would definitely first give Taiwan a heads up and say, here's how things are. Communist Party officials in mainland China are demanding that Taiwan agree that the two sides are a single country before talks can take place. Taiwanese officials have watched for African swine flu since China confirmed its first case last August. The official Xinhua news agency said 81 cases had been reported in 21 Chinese provinces by early December. Taiwan's central news agency reported that African swine flu could severely harm the island's pig farming industry if it spread. That industry is valued at more than $2.5 billion. Before the hog washed up on Kinmen, officials at Taiwan's airports had already been increasing punishments for people who brought pig meat into the country. Another hog later washed up on another small island. That animal, however, was not infected. Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen discussed the incident in her New Year's speech. She demanded that China provide more information. The other side's government has never, according to agreements, given honest and timely reports on the outbreak to Taiwan, she said. In a message on Facebook, government spokesperson Golas Yotaka questioned whether the second hog incident was a biochemical bomb from China. Tsai's party supports long-term self-rule from China. However, Chinese President Xi Jinping has said Taiwan must accept that Taiwan is part of China and the two must unify. Mainland China's Taiwan Affairs Office said last month that it does not need to provide information about animal health issues to the island. The office said that, under a 2010 agricultural inspection agreement between the two sides, Taiwan does not permit Chinese imports of pig meat. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Malaysia's national news agency reported Monday that the nation's ruling families have agreed to vote for a new king. King Muhammad V served as Malaysia's largely ceremonial chief of state until he unexpectedly resigned on Sunday. The vote on his replacement reportedly will take place on January 24th. The king resigned after being in power for just 2 years. This is the first time one of Malaysia's kings has stepped down before completing a 5-year term. No reason was given for the resignation. The 49-year-old leader had only just returned to his official duties last week after spending 2 months on medical leave. Images reportedly showing him getting married in Russia appeared on social media in December. Posts identified his new wife as Oksana Voevodina, who won a Miss Moscow beauty competition in 2015. Officials working for King Mohammed have yet to answer requests for comment on the pictures or reports of a marriage. Media has also reported tension between the king and the government of Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad. Mahathir, who served as Malaysia's prime minister from 1981 to 2003, returned to power last year. Malaysia is a constitutional monarchy, where the king's duties are largely ceremonial and the rest of government operates independently. The king's duties include acting as protector of Islam in the Muslim-majority country. The king's approval is needed for the appointment of a prime minister and other top officials. Malaysia's 9 royal families take turns to provide a king, who is chosen through a vote in a council of rulers. This group is made up of the 9 households, most of which are led by a sultan. A vote must be held within 4 weeks of a king leaving office. Heads of 6 of the 9 households met on Monday at the National Palace to decide a date for the election of a new king. The council agreed that a new king would be elected January 24th. That person would then officially take power on January 31st, the council said in a statement. One sultan could not attend the meeting Monday because he was unwell, while another was outside the country, the council said. The third sultan who was not present was King Muhammad. Earlier on Monday, Mahathir said the government hoped the council would elect a new king as soon as possible. He added that the government needed to keep the king informed of certain matters, Bernama reported. Mahathir led the opposition to a historic election win in May, defeating a group that had governed Malaysia for 60 years.
From VOA, Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Most healthy children between the ages of 4 and 10 grow about 5 centimeters a year. Parents often notice this growth by how quickly their children grow out of their clothes and shoes. However, when a child does not reach usual growth markers, it could be a sign of a health problem. One American family knew something might be wrong when their son was able to fit into the same clothes season after season. Spencer Bayman is a boy who loves to play baseball.
My goal is to play college baseball.
But at age 11, he was much shorter than everyone on his team. Although his small size did not stop Spencer from playing the sport he loves, it did make him feel different.
I want to be as tall as these kids.
At first, Spencer's parents thought their son was just small. But over time, they began to worry that something was wrong. When springtime came around and baseball season started, Spencer tried on his old cleats, a type of sports shoe. They still easily fit on his feet. That is when his mom called the doctor.
It really set in 1 year coming out of winter into spring when he got out his cleats for spring baseball and he put them on, they fit. And they never should have fit. Those were from the spring prior.
Spencer's parents went to see Dr. Bert Bachrach. He is the chief of pediatric endocrinology at University of Missouri Healthcare. After much measuring and testing, Dr. Bachrach found the cause of Spencer's growth failure, a growth hormone deficiency. In other words, Spencer's body was not making enough growth hormone. Hormones are chemicals in the body. They send messages from one cell to another. Growth hormones are necessary for physical growth in children. The levels of growth hormone rise throughout childhood. The levels are highest during puberty. This hormone helps to control many functions in the body. Dr. Bachrach explains.
Growth hormone just doesn't affect your growth. It affects your muscle mass and fat distribution, so that affects your cholesterol. It also affects your overall sense of well-being.
Growth hormone deficiency is a disorder involving the pituitary gland. The pituitary gland is small, about the size of a pea. It is located at the base of the brain. This small gland produces many hormones, not just the growth hormone. Several things can affect the pituitary gland's ability to produce growth hormones. Growth hormone deficiency is mainly the result of damage to the pituitary gland, or hypothalamus, while the fetus is growing in the mother's womb. It can also happen as a result of genetic mutation. And in some cases, children who severely lack emotional and social experiences do not produce enough growth hormone and stop growing. These children often start growing again when they begin receiving the care and human interaction they need. In Spencer's case, he needed daily hormone injections. His mother has been giving him the injection every day for the past 2 years. In that time, Spencer has grown about 15 centimeters. But just in case he does not grow as tall as he would like, he has a reminder to himself written into each of his baseball hats.
It says HDMH, which means height doesn't measure heart.
When used this way, heart means bravery, determination, and emotional strength, all things that Spencer is not in short supply of. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about the Amistad case. The Amistad was a slave ship from Cuba. In 1839, it appeared off the eastern coast of the United States. The Africans on the ship had killed white crew members, including the captain. They demanded to go back home to Africa. But the two remaining slave traders on the ship secretly sailed the Amistad toward the United States. The U.S. government put the Africans in a low-security prison in New Haven, Connecticut, and it made plans to take the Africans to court. A judge would decide whether the occupants of the ship were slaves who had rebelled, murderers, or captives who had been kidnapped from their homes. The Amistad case brought attention once again to the issue of slavery in the United States. At the time, slavery was legal and an important part of the country's economy. But the U.S. and several European countries had banned the international slave trade. A small group of activists wanted to totally end slavery. They believed slavery was a sin. But in the 1830s, most Americans did not support these anti-slavery activists known as abolitionists.
Most Americans, first of all, were racist, and secondly, saw these people as utter fanatics who were intent on destroying the Union.
Julie Roy Jeffrey is a professor of history at Goucher College in Maryland. She says newspapers reported on the Amistad case, and people began talking about slavery and the slave trade. Slowly, some Americans' feelings toward the abolitionist movement and enslaved Africans changed.
For example, there was a play put on in New York City called The Black Schooner that was based on the Amistad incident. And there were many, many people who went to see it. It became a popular event. And wax figures of the captives were exhibited in various places in the United States, and artists drew pictures of them.
The abolitionists wanted to make more Americans sympathetic to the Amistad Africans. They found lawyers to represent them, paid tutors to teach them, and organized outdoor exercises to keep them healthy and visible. Howard Jones taught history at the University of Virginia. He says one of the most popular members of the Amistad Africans was an 8-year-old boy who had learned English. The boy told the public about his life in Africa and about the conditions on the slave ship that brought him across the Atlantic Ocean. The Amistad case also was increasingly becoming a political issue. People wanted to know what President Martin Van Buren was going to do about the case. Historian Howard Jones says Van Buren found the position difficult. He did not want to anger Southern voters who supported slavery and wanted to make the African slave trade legal again. He also did not want to anger Northern voters who believed the Amistad Africans had been mistreated.
Van Buren did what any good politician would do, and that was to try to dodge the issue, stay away from it. He couldn't understand why 40-plus, by this time, black people should affect anything happening in high political society.
But the Amistad issue would not go away. The case began in a circuit court. After 3 days, it went to a district court. The district court judge ruled that the African slave trade was illegal under international treaties. For that reason, the Africans were wrongly taken. President Van Buren was worried the decision would cause more political problems for him, so he ordered the nation's highest court, the Supreme Court, to hear the case. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court at that time was Joseph Story. Story did not like slavery, but he did not support the abolitionist movement either. He thought its ideas opposed the rule of law. The abolitionists had good lawyers, but they knew they needed more help arguing their case in the Supreme Court. So they turned to former President John Quincy Adams. At the time, Adams was a congressman, not an abolitionist. But he led a campaign against an 1836 rule restricting anti-slavery petitions. Adams said the rule was a violation of the constitutional right to petition Congress. Historian Julie Jeffrey says the 1836 gag rule, as it was called, helped the abolitionists' cause.
It became partly a freedom of speech issue, not just about slavery, but about the rights of citizens to speak out and to be heard by their representatives in Congress.
Yet John Quincy Adams was not excited about arguing the Amistad case. He was 72 years old, nearly blind, and very busy. But the issue of the Amistad Africans troubled him. Howard Jones says Adams believed capturing people and enslaving them was immoral, especially in a country like the United States. In the end, Adams agreed to defend the Africans.
And he makes the argument in the court case that we have the Declaration of Independence right there on that wall, and that says that life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, it doesn't say for white people only or anything like that. He was trying to argue that it's something that's available for everyone. It's part of the justice system.
Chief Justice Joseph Story did not totally accept Adams' argument or suggest that any kind of slavery was wrong, but he did agree with the district court that these Africans had been taken illegally from their homes. They were not and had never been slaves, Justice Story said. They were free people and should be returned home. So in 1841, the remaining 30 or so members of the Amistad captives got on a ship called the Gentleman and returned to West Africa. Howard Jones says the incident was the only time he knows that black people who had been brought to the New World as slaves actually made it back home.
And how they do it? By winning in the American court system. This was just unheard of. But the decision was basically that it doesn't matter whether you are black, white, purple, green, or whatever color you are, you have been kidnapped. And so therefore you have, and Joseph Story said this in his decision, which really opened the door for a lot of arguments, that under the eternal principles of justice, you have the inherent right of self-defense, even if you must kill your captors.
Howard Jones says the Supreme Court decision also gave the abolitionists a new sense of power.
And the abolitionists immediately printed pamphlets, leaflets, had talks, everything they could to show that these people went free. And their implication was, this is what's going to happen to slavery itself, that this is a great victory for the black man.
But the Amistad case did not really change the situation in the United States for most black people. Many were the children of slaves and could not argue that they had been kidnapped from Africa. And it was still legal to trade slaves across U.S. state borders. The Amistad case also did not solve all the problems in the abolitionist movement. Julie Roy Jeffries says during the trials, many abolitionists worked together, including blacks and whites.
It sometimes worked very well, and it sometimes didn't work so well, but it was certainly one of the first times that blacks and whites had worked so fruitfully together.
After the Amistad victory, though, the abolitionist movement broke into different groups. Ms. Jeffrey says some black abolitionists wanted more respect from white activists. Other abolitionists just had different ideas about how best to end slavery, by trying to change the country's laws or by appealing to Americans' moral sense of right and wrong. Abolitionism did influence other movements, however. One was the missionary movement. Julie Roy Jeffrey says Christian missionaries had already been going to Africa, hoping to persuade people to follow their religion. But the Amistad case and abolitionism made more people want to share their beliefs with others. Some missionaries even converted the Amistad captives to Christianity and returned to West Africa with them. Ms. Jeffrey says the abolitionist movement also helped create the women's movement in the middle of the 1800s. She says most 19th century white women mainly cared for their families in the home, but women abolitionists played an important public role.
They weighed in on the most political question of the day. They took on activities like collecting petition signatures and raising money and giving speeches.
As a result, Ms. Jeffrey says, some women came to believe they had a right to develop their own beliefs and have political power.
Sometimes they propped up their activism by appealing to things like the Bible. One woman I remember said something like, I read my Bible and I know what it tells me. And she was opposing the minister in her church, and she was a very active abolitionist.
Yet, even if abolitionism still did not personally affect most Americans, it made an increasing number of people question whether they wanted slavery to continue. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.